Welcome to this special encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, we'll explore the world of predatory academic journals and how they'll, in some cases, print pretty much almost anything you send them. But first, if you've spent any time looking for a new job recently, then you know that technology makes it a lot easier. Or perhaps you're an employer looking for new candidates. There are online search tools and networking sites like LinkedIn. You can conduct interviews via video and use the web to search for tips on everything from resume templates to how to dress to impress. Technology has also become so sophisticated that many companies are using artificial intelligence to filter through resumes and even answer applicant questions. But think about all the controversy about Facebook's algorithm when it determines our news feed. Now, think about using other algorithms to determine who gets an interview. Alexia Alejalde Ruiz reported on this for the Chicago Tribune. Jeffrey Blumenfeld is the director of Career Moves at JVS Chicago, which provides career counseling and exploration services. And Tony Lee works for the Society of Human Resource Management. I spoke with them last summer, and I started by asking Alexia to tell us some of the ways that technology and AI are being used in hiring.
Yeah, so we're kind of at the start of it. So some of the ways that we're starting to see it are, for example, little chat tools on a company's career site that allow people to apply for jobs using kind of just like natural language, so they don't have to necessarily upload a resume. They can instead, you know, the little chat bot asks them, like, you know, when are you available, for example, if you're applying for a restaurant job? Are you over 18? Stuff like that, so you can kind of have a back and forth with a little robot. And it's supposed to, the idea is that it can understand your language and, you know, ask relevant follow-up questions. And then there are other ways, you know, there for companies that are searching for, like, passive candidates, they'll put, like, web crawlers that'll just search all the publicly available information to search for people who might be appropriate for a role, and then they compile kind of a database of potential candidates. And then the other way that I think is one of the more interesting and also one of the more controversial ways is in these hiring algorithms that companies are using, to in which they analyze their existing top performers at their work and create an algorithm based on that, and then have and then look for people or evaluate candidates based on that information to find similar people, people with similar traits, so that they can find the best fit for the company.
I want to get to those hiring algorithms, back to that in a moment, Alexia. But can I first ask you, I was surprised to learn from your story that job applicants are in some cases even video recording themselves answering interview questions. How common is that?
Yeah, so when I spoke with a man, actually, who Jeff at JVS put me in touch with, he was saying that on frequently, like, it's not uncommon for him to have to get on, you know, do an interview with the computer, basically, so the computer spits automated questions at him, and he has, like, 2 minutes to think about it, and then he has 40 seconds to answer, or the other way around, and then, you know, the computer spits the next question at him, and stuff like that, and so he's being recorded, so they're seeing him, you know, how he speaks and how he responds and everything like that, but he doesn't have anybody else on the other side.
Jeff, as you're working to train people looking for jobs, I wonder how that's changed and how you're helping people navigate this new digital culture.
I think there are a number of factors that are involved that make it extremely helpful and useful for individuals in terms of the speed at which people can access information and the variety of information that's available. But on the downside, there are a number of individuals who find that technology is intimidating, and that can be a very difficult process, especially in terms of some of the means in which you were just discussing that people are accessing an interview process. So, for instance, an individual who would be well-rehearsed and feel comfortable being able to speak to a blank screen and answer questions would have no problem and would probably do very well. There's some individuals who, like myself, I have a very difficult time because I find it really important to pick up on the cues that we get from seeing a person and from interacting with people. So it's a real mixed bag at this point in time.
And I wonder, Tony, if you can weigh in here from SHRM's perspective, the Society of Human Resource Management, why are companies using tools like this? Is it just to make the process a little bit more cost efficient as well as efficient overall?
Well, it's not necessarily cost efficient. It's more reacting to an incredible talent shortage that's going on, you know, nationwide and beyond. Companies are struggling to fill a number of positions from hourly to the executive suite. And just to try and keep up with that demand, HR is doing everything it can to identify qualified candidates and then get through the process of having them interviewed and approved and hired as quickly as possible. Every empty position that's not filled costs companies money. And so they're very motivated to try and find the best fits and get them in place as quickly as possible. So as a result, you'll see companies adopt the technologies that we're talking about to try and speed the process. I mean, Amazon's a great example of one that's leading the way in terms of a number of their positions. Candidates are offered jobs before they've ever met anyone in person. They have tests that they can take online to prove their skills in a certain area. A lot of it's IT, but others as well. And if they score to a certain level, the next message they see on their screen is, congratulations, would you like to come work for us? So, you know, companies need to do what they can in this environment to try and identify and hire folks as quickly and efficiently as they can.
Alexia, as Tony is describing this, I immediately just think, are there legal issues with doing that? Or what other pitfalls did you find in your reporting from this digitization of the job process?
Right. So a risk in creating the algorithms, for example, is that the training set that you use to train the algorithm, meaning the original employee sample, you know, whether that has bias baked into it. So, for example, if you have a big concern, you know, in the hiring process is that humans are, you know, inherently can have biases. They prefer people who have gone to their alma mater, or they just have a certain idea of what somebody should look like when there's role, and it's not blatantly, you know, trying to be discriminatory, but there it is. And so the idea is that if you're training an algorithm based on the people who have been promoted in the past, who have gotten raises in the past, who are, you know, doing well in a job for one reason or another, then that could bake in certain qualities that could potentially set you up for violating an anti-discrimination law, because algorithms look for patterns, you know, so they just might take a whole lot of information and kind of create this like idea of, but I'm not a technology person, so I'm not going to use the right words, but, you know, they look for patterns, and the potential risk is that it could screen people out based on whether it's race or age or, you know, other or disability or other things that are protected by anti-discrimination laws, and that could potentially put employers at risk, although granted it's always very hard to prove that.
Tony, do you think lots of employers, I imagine even huge employers like Amazon, certainly are considering those legal ramifications as well as they're thinking about these algorithms or these tests?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a couple of things to think about here. First of all, the testing that's being done are not algorithms that are based on past performance of employees. They're based on future performance on very specific skills. So if you look at the algorithms asking whether or not someone can code in a certain way or can connect the dots in a logistics issue a certain way, they're not based on how others have done it in the past. They're calculations. They're mathematical. So they do their best to remove bias that way. Now, that said, there is no question that implicit bias is a problem and an issue that every company is struggling with to make sure that their hiring managers are, you know, acting on clear and rational and relevant data and not allowing their biases to come in. But I want to share one example of how technology eliminated this bias. Analytics is huge in HR right now, and every HR professional is doing their best to become math experts, even though most of them got into HR because they weren't math experts. But consider the case of a company that had a big college recruiting program. And every year they would go to the same colleges to do the same recruiting. And the colleges they selected were because they were the alma maters of their CEO and their CFO and their other executives. And so they were hiring at colleges where they didn't know if they were the right places to be. They were just going there because that's the bias of senior management. When they applied analytics, they found that their model needed to be flipped on its head, that the kind of elite schools that they had been going to, because that's where their senior executives went, the employees they hired lasted the shortest amount of period with the company and ended up the lowest rated for those who remained. On the other hand, employees they had hired from local community colleges and from other local state schools turned out to be the most loyal, best-performing employees they had. And they found that through using analytics. So it actually removed all biases, and they changed their recruiting process because the analytics showed that they were better off going to schools where that was more diverse and had a wider array of candidates.
We're talking about the technology and digitization of the job process with, that's Tony Lee with the Society for Human Resource Management. Alexia Elejalde Ruiz is also with us. She's a business reporter who first was reporting on this with the Chicago Tribune. Jeffrey Blumenfeld is with us as well, and he works to provide career counseling and exploration services. Jeff, I wanted to come back to you as we were just discussing this whole notion of tests and job processes and doing everything online. There is a certain level of digital savvy that is required with that. And I wonder what you're seeing with the folks that you're working with. If they don't have that level of comfort, are you concerned that they're now left out of a lot of opportunities within the labor market?
I think that you find the biggest disparity in an age group where those individuals have not grown up with technology, so that you are obviously looking at individuals that are probably 50 plus. And even though they have a certain comfort level with technology on a day-to-day basis, the learning curve is a greater learning curve. It's a slower curve for many individuals, although once they are up to speed in terms of whatever technology they're trying to acclimate to, they're absolutely every bit as good in terms of their skill sets as anyone else would be. But there is a different learning curve as a result of not growing up with technology and it not being something that they're as easily comfortable with as a younger group. So you do find that older individuals shy away from many of the means in which people could access employment as a result of their hesitancy to become involved with technology. And it's a real challenge for older workers to be able to move into certain spots in employment that are open to them, but because of their comfort level, it doesn't exist.
I wonder, Jeff, how much this is different, though, than the unfortunate, certainly, but very real age discrimination we've seen in the workplace. By and large, we hear lots of older workers talking about how hard it is for them to get jobs. Is this any different?
I think in some ways it is different because it's a matter of individuals basically confronting the fact that there are younger workers in the workforce that they need to learn to feel comfortable with. And I think most people that are older actually embrace that mixture of young and old in the workplace. There's a lot to be said for that mixture of what older workers bring to the workforce and what younger workers bring. So in that sense, I don't think it becomes as much an issue, but I think in the just purely acclimating technology, I think it is an issue in terms of their being able to, once again, to access jobs in the same way that perhaps younger workers would.
Just one last question for you, Jeff, then. How are you? Are you just doing practicing? Like, I wonder when you're working with people with career counseling, is it just a matter of getting them comfortable with this format and operating within this realm?
We spend a lot of time supporting our clients through the process of learning to interview, whether it's online, whether it's in person, whether it's over the phone, whether the phone is a screening or an actual interview. So there are many different ways in which we can support them in that process, and they can learn to certainly become more comfortable not only with the technology, but also with the process. It is a challenge, I would say that, and that it's not for everybody. There are certainly individuals, as I said before, that do shy away from it, and they will gravitate towards jobs that they can get the old-fashioned way by networking, by actually face-to-face interviewing and going through that process. But I would say that obviously those individuals who are open to learning and moving in that direction really reap the benefits of a much broader variety of job opportunities.
That's Jeff Blumenfeld with the Director of Career Moves at JVS Chicago. They provide career counseling and exploration services. I want to thank Tony Lee as well with the Society for Human Resource Management and, of course, the Chicago Tribune's Alexia Elejalde Ruiz for bringing this topic to our attention. Thanks for being with me, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Professors and scholars spend a lot of time trying to get their articles and studies published in academic journals, and we in the public trust those academic journals represent a stamp of approval. But it turns out hundreds of academic journals are put out by companies that will publish almost anything that gets submitted. And these companies make millions of dollars from these journals and from fake academic conferences. Sylvia Eckhart has been investigating these companies. She's with us from Hamburg, Germany, where she's an investigative journalist, mainly covering technology for ARD, Germany's largest public broadcaster. Chris Sumner is also on the line from London, where he's co-founder and research director with the Online Privacy Foundation. I spoke with him last fall, and I first started by asking Sylvia to explain what she means by, quote, fake journals.
Fake journals, they look like real journals, and they advertise with, we are peer-reviewed, we are super excellent, we have super scientists. But the truth is that you can publish there even a computer-generated nonsense paper, or you can publish there a made-up cancer study, and nobody would notice. So they are faking the scientific process, and this is what is fake about them.
Another way I think you've described them is as predatory journals. How are they predatory?
Yeah, they are robbing scientists. This is what the predatory is about, though. A scientist or university, they pay a lot of money to publish there. Sometimes it's less, sometimes it's more than $1,000. They promise that they are operating legit, but they don't. And that's why they are predators, because they are robbing scientists, they are robbing universities.
And Sylvia, you mainly looked into a company called the World Academy of Science, Engineering and Technology, or WASET. There's also another company called Omix. How many of these unreviewed articles are there? How many things are we talking about being published here?
When we started this investigation, we first of all tried to figure out who may be a very big publisher in this market. So, because you have thousands of these fake journals out there, and some of them are small, some of them are bigger. And what we tried first was to look who's big in the market. And we found that this alleged World Academy of Science and Technology, that they are one of the bigger players with around 60,000 abstracts. And then we have Omix, which is a company from India, and they are quite a bigger company, and they have also more than 60,000 abstracts. And we investigated another predatory publisher, and in total, we gathered together around 180,000 abstracts or articles where you don't know if they are peer-reviewed or not. So it says they are, but as we prove with many various fake papers, we prove that they are not.
I'm speaking with Saveya Eckert. She's an investigative journalist, and we're talking about her work. More than 6 months that she spent investigating this for ARD, this Germany's largest public broadcaster. Chris Sumner is also on the line with us. He's the co-founder and research director of the Online Privacy Foundation in London. Chris, I understand you submitted a paper to WASIT on political psychology, and then you attended one of their conferences, which turned out to be pretty much a fake conference. How did you first find out about the conference, and then how did you decide you were going to attend?
We'd narrowed it down to a couple of conferences that we'd found on, you know, by Google, I guess. And the reason we wanted to submit to the conference was really to get fairly early feedback into some research we were still writing up, which is pretty common in academia. And the conferences that we found really didn't look any different, at least the websites didn't look any different to reputable conferences that we had previously, you know, presented at or had attended.
And Chris, I wonder if you can explain a little bit more of that process for those of us who aren't in this world and in academia. You, the process of finding a publication, how do you go about doing that? And how do you determine, as you said, you were doing this because you were trying to get some early feedback. I imagine, did you try to do that before you were thinking of targeting a bigger publication for your research?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. In previous research we'd conducted, we had partnerships with academia and the conferences were fairly clear. And when it came to political psychology, yeah, we were fairly early on in the research. I mean, we'd conducted the research, we had some preliminary findings. And in looking for those conferences, you know, we looked at Google and the, you know, certainly the WASIT conference for international political psychology came up pretty high. So we kind of shortlisted that conference along with another one, which, you know, the other one turned out to be legitimate. And really, the process there is that, at least for submitting an abstract, you know, you're doing so to share, if you like, preliminary results with the hope that you extend the peer group that are looking at your research and offering early feedback. And then you can take that early feedback and that might help shape how you write up your paper, how you consider the, you know, the discussion section of your academic paper. So, you know, it can be a valuable exercise, and that's really what we were looking to do.
So, Chris, you walk into this conference. How did you know that this was fake, or what felt wrong?
You know, looking back, there were a few warning signs before we even attended. The conference schedule looked like it had been condensed into an hour and a half rather than 2 days, you know, but I just put those down to administrative errors. And so, you know, it didn't bat too much of an eyelid at that. It's only when you look back that you think, well, maybe that was a red flag. But it wasn't really until I arrived at the event, you know, itself, I don't really want to call it a conference, that the penny began to drop, if you like. Usually you go to a conference, if it's in a hotel, you're going to see, you know, a number of people, you know, sort of milling around the night before, either having a drink at the bar or something. And the hotel was pretty empty. So that I thought was, you know, a little weird, but, you know, these things happen. And then the conference itself, there were maybe, you know, 10 to 15 people attended in what was a very small room. And what I'd noticed was that all of the other talks had nothing at all to do with political psychology. They were on things like Iranian finance and farming and, you know, advanced robotics and what have you. So I wondered whether I'd missed a communication.
Right, because it sounds like those are 15 different conferences, right?
Well, that's exactly it. You know, afterwards, on Googling it, you know, you find out that actually they host a multitude of different international conferences in the same run on the same day. So it's almost like everybody attending is attending their very own unique conference. You know, you may well have stayed at home and presented your material in a cupboard because that's how many people would have, you know, sort of had an interest. It wasn't really until after that first half a morning that really went back and investigated a little bit more about the conference and found out that other people had indeed had the same experience and written about it, you know, and that sort of, you know, the WASIT conference was really, if you like, a form of academic fraud. And my biggest fear there wasn't, you know, reclaiming the money we'd spent on the conference, which was about €450. The biggest fear was the amount of effort we put into writing the abstract and reclaiming the abstract for the paper, if you like, our intellectual property.
We're talking about predatory academic journals and conferences. Based on the research by investigative journalist Saveya Eckhart, she covers technology for ARD, that's Germany's largest public broadcaster. She's on the line with us from Hamburg talking about her more than 6 months of look into this world, the thousands of academic journals that are articles from academic journals that we're talking about that are not peer reviewed but seem to be. Chris Sumner has been with us sharing his experience with these groups. He's on the line from London, where he's co-founder and research director with the Online Privacy Foundation. In our studios in Urbana, Kelly Tri is also with us. She's a biosciences librarian and assistant professor at the University of Illinois. Hi, Kelly. Thanks for being with us as well.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Kelly, I imagine for people in academia, for you in the library sciences world, are you probably already familiar with the fact that this is happening?
Yeah, it has been a bit of an ongoing conversation in our research areas as well, and trying to think how to address it with our students and faculty.
And is there already in the journal world sort of a hierarchy of journals in terms of prestige and publication and peer review?
There are certainly journals that have, there's a ranking process, and there's certainly journals that are heavily respected and well-known, but there are also many brand new journals that are doing a very good job with peer review. And I think part of the problems of this predatory publishing is it also affects them poorly because people assume that maybe they're part of this when really they're just new and not established yet. So although there is a ranking, there's practices that are true across the board for any reputable journal.
Saveya, I wonder, when we're thinking about these articles, when we say, first of all, the concept of peer-reviewed, are we assuming then that peer reviews don't happen in the case of these predatory journals?
This varies a lot. So for WASET, this alleged World Academy, we could prove in multiple ways that there is not a peer review. So you send your article in, and it could even be some computer-generated rubbish. And then you get some kind of reply like, could you please write 10 more words in the abstract?
And that's so, what you did. You actually did computer-generated, yes. And you submitted a paper like this.
Yes, it was a complete nonsense papers. No sentence made any sense, and it was completely randomized. So you only had the subject, verb, object, and you had a lot of buzzwords in it. But that was all, and this was the only kind of peer review we got for this paper. And not only we did this, but we had multiple media partners. I think 10 different media organizations from all around the world, they submitted to this World Academy a variety of computer-generated fake papers. And they always got this crude answer, like, could you add more words here, or could you add more quotations or something like this? So there is no discussion. You don't get real answers from other scientists. So I would say this was the worst what I saw. We had another predatory publisher where we also got some comments like, good work, thank you. They just accepted it. They did not comment on anything. And then there were some predatory journals where I think it's more difficult because we sent in the computer-generated content, and then they had many remarks on this rubbish. And I was really surprised, because who could read that? But obviously, I think it was just some random comments. Something like, could you please explain more on this or that? And then I added more computer-generated rubbish, and then it went through. So they tried to even make something up. They tried to make it look like a peer review, but you could add any more rubbish, and you know they would publish it anyway. And sometimes there was, like, you had three reviewers, and one voice was, this is complete rubbish, this is nonsense. And then you had two voices, and they said, they only have to spend a little bit more work. And one voice was, excellent work, very valuable research. And then you add more rubbish, and then it got published, like, you know, after the second time. So this were the two cases. And then we had a third case where it was with omics. There we presented a computer-generated paper, and it did not get through. But my colleagues from the newspaper, they did something different. They made a study completely up. So it made sense in a way. It was a cancer drug made from beeswax. And they said, okay, it is because bees, they don't get cancer. And because bees don't get cancer, you give people beeswax and then they will heal. So total also nonsense. As a literature, I think they had a children's book as an expert on it. And so there were many hints that this study is rubbish. But with omics at the, I think, Journal of Oncology, then at omics, it went through. And they did not have bigger remarks. So this was also for us a big indicator that there is no serious peer review. And I think the problem is that they advertise it. And as we did this research basically for the normal consumer, we did this because we thought, how as a cancer patient, you know, or as somebody who wants information about climate change, you have these studies and they are standing next to, yeah, to legit studies and legit universities. And then you have studies from snake oil sellers or climate change skepticisms. And these studies, they are standing next to each other in one journal. As a normal people, not from academia, you can't decide. And this was the main reason why we did this investigation.
And I wanted to, for Kelly, I wonder if you can explain for people who aren't in academia what peer review is and why it is so important. I mean, these are obviously obvious examples, right? Because we don't want people making up things. But when we're getting down to actual academic research, why is peer review important?
It's basically a system of trust in science. So when a researcher publishes or is attempting to publish a new article, so they've created this article about the research project that they did, and they submit it to a journal, it gets sent usually to two other experts in that field, who then have to look through the research carefully and comment on its veracity, whether or not all the information is there in the paper to be reproduced, and whether or not it's novel, whether or not it's contributing something new to that area of science, so or of research. So it means that you have experts looking at your work and basically giving you feedback about whether or not it is useful. Usually they send back comments and questions asking you to clarify terms and points, which means by the time it actually gets published, the idea is that the consumer, the person reading it, the other researcher interested in this topic, has some idea that this has been vetted as well as it can. Obviously, research could still be something that can't be reproduced, but it helps show that other experts in this field think this is valid and of interest to people.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation about predatory academic journals with Chris Sumner, Saveya Eckhart, and Kelly Try. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. And if you're just tuning in, we've been revisiting our conversation about predatory academic journals. My guests are Chris Sumner, co-founder and research director with the Online Privacy Foundation in London. Saveya Eckhart reported on this for ARD, Germany's largest public broadcaster. And Kelly Try is a biosciences librarian and assistant professor at the University of Illinois. Let's hear the rest of that conversation from last fall. Chris, in the case of your paper that you initially were working on and had WESAT publish, have you now gone through a process of having it? Are you still working on that paper, or where are you at with that now?
We were able to withdraw the abstract from WESAT, and I think that's because we've made such a public stink about it. And then working with Sveja, that I think they removed that. So with the paper itself, we released what's called a working paper, which is really the draft that you make or that you can make public before you send it off for peer review. And we released that in July. What we wanted was some feedback from peers and whatnot, and now we're in the process of sending that off to a journal where it will be formally peer reviewed. So right now it's available on the Open Science Framework website, where anybody could go and see it. It makes no attempt to say it was peer reviewed at this point, in that it is a preprint or a working paper, probably is the more accurate term. So we're still hopeful that that will be peer reviewed and published, but there are many obstacles to navigate on that journey.
Kelly, I wonder how much of this is because people in academia often face a lot of pressure to get published. Do you think that that's partially why these outlets have been able to exist?
I think certainly possibly that's part of it, in particular with brand new researchers or even graduate students, you know, trying to get their feet wet in this area. I think also, you know, there's money in publishing. There's a lot of, you know, grants that people receive to do their research, and these predatory entities are aware there's money available, and so they're you know, trying to capitalize on that.
Right, Savea, to your point, millions of dollars. I wonder, since you all, the work that you've done, as you mentioned, Chris had partnered with you at a certain point, what's been the, since all of your investigations have come out, what kind of response have you gotten from these companies?
From the companies, I must admit there was not a lot of response. I think they were not happy. I think the biggest response, and this was something we really appreciated, and what we thought this is a great outcome, was the biggest response was from the universities. So in every country where we published, or our media partners published, so the story got published in Japan, in Norway, many European countries, in India, in South Korea, and universities were really trying to fix this and to react. So they started with little tutorials and FAQs and, you know, to make people aware. And they also pushed internal investigations. So they were looking at their own people. And, you know, if somebody is submitting their once or twice, I think universities, it's not a big issue. It can happen. But if there are people or institutions who are publishing there over years, and they are publishing like 50 or 60 times, then I think it's an university's biggest interest to investigate this and to question this. Because if you go to this conference, for example, or if you go to one of this alleged peer review process, then you recognize, okay, something is wrong. Okay, won't do it again. Fine. But if you do this over years, then of course it's good to question it and to ask, okay, why are you doing this? What I would like to ask Kelly, but before our conversation, I looked into University of Illinois, and of course I found many scientists who also have published at Omics and WASET, for example, until 2018, so until this year, and I was really interested what you would say to that, or how hard it probably is to warn people.
I think it's certainly difficult to have these conversations and to get the news out. It's hard, I think, with the sheer amount of information in library community, we call it information overload, but the amount of information and publishing and things that are happening for people to stay up on, you know, possible predatory publishing. And I think what my goal is as a librarian, and working with students in particular, is really trying to get people to think about the critical evaluation of where they're publishing. It can be overwhelming and you're pressured to hurry up and, you know, publish, but you really have to look at these potential journals and look at, are they telling you all the information? Can you find the editorial board information? Do they tell you their peer review process? Have you looked at papers to see, you know, does this seem like legit publishing? Unfortunately, I don't think anymore we can assume, based on even the structure of a website, you really have to, I think, critically vet every single place you choose to publish. And that's the thing I think I'm trying to impart as much as possible.
We will tweet out some of the stories that have been written about this issue. I should also say that Savea worked on a documentary called Inside the Fake Science Factory that does have English subtitles, and that video is available to view online. I want to thank her, Savea Eckhart, for joining us from Hamburg at ARD, Germany's largest public broadcaster. Chris Sumner is the co-founder and research director at the Online Privacy Foundation in London, and Kelly Try is a biosciences librarian and assistant professor at the University of Illinois. Thanks, all of you, for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll be right back.
When I say the word twins, what comes to mind? Maybe it's a famous set of twins, like the Olsen twins or the astronauts Scott and Mark Kelly. Maybe you're a twin yourself. Well, 1 in 30 births in the U.S. are twin births. That's nearly 130,000 births, according to the CDC's latest numbers. And it turns out twin research, as it's often called, can tell us a lot, not just about twins, but about many different areas of life, whether it's genetics, child development, health, or other things. Now, for the first time, Illinois has its own statewide database of twins, triplets, other multiples who want to participate and possibly help researchers with their work. It's called the Illinois Twins Project, and it was launched by Northwestern University and the University of Illinois. Jennifer Tackett is the co-principal investigator of the project. She's also an associate professor of psychology at Northwestern. I spoke with her back in May, and I started by asking how she got interested in twin research.
That's a good question. I actually was really interested in personality and aggression, which is what I study, and ended up doing my PhD at the University of Minnesota, which has one of the biggest centers for twin and family research in the world. So I sort of fell into twin research, and it got me hooked, and I haven't been able to get away from it yet.
And so I mentioned we can learn a lot about other topics from twins. Why is that?
Well, twin research is a really powerful tool that allows us to start to disentangle the extent to which our genes and our environments influence the people we are in many, many different ways. So it's a great scientific platform that can be leveraged to answer lots and lots of different scientific questions.
And how does this, for example, in your work, how would you use twin research?
Well, there are lots of ways to use it as well. So there are many variations on these designs that can be pretty powerful. One of the ways it's often used is if we're interested in understanding the extent to which some of our behaviors are learned, which we would think of as an environmental process. We can think of something like the personality trait of extroversion versus introversion. So we know from twin research that if we have a child who's extroverted versus introverted, there's a pretty substantial genetic influence on this personality trait. But we also know from twin research that as parents, we're probably not kind of teaching the child to be extroverted. So it doesn't seem to be happening through this environmental process of modeling. On the other hand, there are some behaviors we found in my research that do show this modeling effect. So an example of that is what we would call relational aggression or kind of mean girls behavior. So this sort of gossipy social exclusion kind of behavior does seem to be influenced by these learning effects, which
is
pretty powerful information.
So that's learned rather than... And then when we think about misconceptions about twins or triplets, are there any that you think are important for people to know or break down here?
I think a common misconception in terms of like the implications of twin research is the extent to which it kind of answers the nature versus nurture debate, which really isn't a debate, right? So we do know that it isn't a question of is it genes or is it environment in this kind of competitive sense. What twin research does is really look at it in a much more complex way, including the extent to which genes and environment interact in sort of this complex interplay to produce various outcomes.
So I wonder if we can get to the Illinois Twins Project. Why do you think it's important for us to have a statewide registry here in Illinois?
Well, twin registries typically exist within geographic regions. There are a few states that have them, but not very many. So there's a real opportunity to do something new here. There are a number of countries as well in other parts of the world that have pretty big twin registries. So it's pretty exciting for Illinois to have its own. One, I think, sort of fun Illinois fact is that New Trier High School actually holds the Guinness World Record for having the most multiples in the same class. I think this was a couple of years ago. They had something like 50 sets of multiples in a single class at New Trier.
Wow. So this is a suburban Chicago high school. Okay.
Right.
So who's eligible here? When we're thinking about multiples, who's eligible for this? Obviously, I think when people say twins, people think of identical twins, but really that's not those aren't the only people you're looking for here, right?
Right. So the way the twin design works is by leveraging the difference between identical or monozygotic twins and fraternal or dizygotic twins. So fraternal twins share an average 50% of their genetic material. Monozygotic twins share 100%. And this is the crux of the twin design, is by looking at similarities between these different kinds of twins. And this includes, you know, opposite sex fraternal pairs, same sex fraternal pairs. And we are open to triplets and larger sets of multiples as well. So really any family with multiples who are age 17 and younger are eligible.
And how can people sign up?
We have a website. It's iltwins.com. So pretty simple URL to remember, I hope. And people can go and learn more about the project and about the various faculty affiliates across both Northwestern and Urbana-Champaign. And then there's also a sign-up form on there as well, and a way to contact us with any questions.
How will people's information be used if they sign up for this, Jennifer?
So at this point, we're just establishing a database. The registry is not committing to participate in any specific project. By being in the database, as studies come up from us or our faculty affiliates, people will be contacted if they're eligible, and they'll then have the option to participate in the study or not. So there's no commitment at this stage. It's just saying, hey, I might be interested if a study comes up that we're eligible for.
And you're only looking for multiples, right? Like, you're not looking for siblings of multiples to register.
Not at this point, but that's a great question, because that is actually a really excellent research design as well. But at this point, we're just starting with the twins and other multiples.
Okay, well, we'll have that information up at 21stshow.org as well. But I want to thank Jennifer Tackett for being with us. Tell us a little bit more about this database that's being created, the Illinois Twins Project. She's an associate professor of psychology at Northwestern. Again, this is a project between Northwestern and U of I. Jennifer, thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you so much.
That does it for us today. You can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. We're also on Facebook. If you want to search there for the 21st, you can like us, and it's another way to comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, if you want to leave us a voicemail as well, send us an email, or remember our social media handles, all you have to remember is our website. That's 21stshow.org. We've also got all of our past shows archived there. You can find us also most places you get your podcasts. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, NPR One. Search for The 21ST. We're produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.